Good afternoon. I'll now call this meeting to order of the Senate Resources Committee. Let the record reflect that it is 3:31 p.m. on Monday, March 21st. Let the record also reflect that we have a quorum present today. Are Senator Stevens, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Keel, myself, Chairman Michicki, filling in for Senator Reback, who is excused on other business. Staffing the committee today are staff N.T. Harbison and LIO moderator Nate Williams and Juliana Singh from Records. This time, please silence your cell phones. For those of you on Teams, please remember to keep yourself muted until it is your turn to speak. Thank you. Today's agenda consists of two items, Senate Bill 177, microreactors, and up today under bills previously heard, HB 79, saltwater sport fishing operators guides. The committee will now take up SB 177, microreactors. Online to present today, we have Gwen Holdman, Director, Alaska Center for Energy and Power. And here in the room, we have Deputy Legislative Director Amy Bushnell. To help us move through the slides. So online for questions, we have Christina Carpenter, Director, Environmental Health DEC, Ashley Feenan, did I say that correctly? Yes, Director, National Reactor Innovation Center, Dr. Allison Natcher, I'm sorry, Dr. Feenan, Dr. Allison Natcher, NRC liaison with DEC, and that's all I see. So, Ms. Holdman, Ms. Bushnell, please feel free to put yourselves on the record and begin whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Gwen. I'm the director of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, calling in from Fairbanks. Not sure why I have an echo. I wanted to give Christina Carpenter an opportunity to lead us off by introducing the bill. Christina, if you want to do that.
Christina, are you available? You may be on mute. In fact, I see your mic is muted. Brief at ease. Senate Resources is back on the record. Ms. Carpenter, can you please introduce SB 177?
Yeah, good. And my name is Christine Carpenter, and I'm with the Department of Environmental Conservation. I'm the Environmental Health Division Director, and I have the pleasure today to introduce Senate Bill 177, an act relating to microreactors. This is a simple one-page bill that defines a microreactor according to the federal definition contained in the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, and it creates a carve-out from the ongoing legislative siting requirements. It creates a carve-out from the ongoing study requirements and the legislative siting requirements. The existing study requirement involves six state departments and was designed to analyze the operations of a massive legacy reactor. And we believe that the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, ACEP, along with national labs, is the appropriate place for these studies. ACEP has been studying this issue for over 10 years and is committed to work with DEC on a microreactor roadmap for Alaska. There are currently no microreactors in Alaska. The time frame for microreactors coming to the market is estimated at 5 to 7 years. Allowing these exemptions now will allow microreactors to be situated without the necessity of legislative approval for lands, reducing the burden on atomic industrial development. The legislative siting requirement reflects the statewide nature of a legacy reactor. A microreactor is a local issue, whereas a legacy reactor has a 50-mile emergency planning zone. A microreactor's emergency planning zone ends at the reactor facility's door. This bill does not remove the requirement that municipalities must approve of the DEC siting permit. In addition to extensive clean energy industry support, Senate Bill 177 has received backing from a diverse group of stakeholders, ranging from forward-thinking Alaskans like the Copper Valley Electric Authority, clean energy nonprofits like Clear Path Action, and our own Alaska Center for Energy and Power in Fairbanks. We expect that list to grow dramatically as we continue to engage with Alaskans in upcoming weeks. Do I have permission to read the sectional analysis?
Yes. If so, I'm sorry, I had a different order for the presentation. You can feel free to provide sectional analysis at this time if you'd like.
Okay. Section 1 removes the requirement for microreactors to be situated on legislatively designated land. Section 2 exempts state departments and agencies from the requirement to conduct studies concerning changes in laws and regulation for microreactors only. And Section 3 provides the definition of microreactor.
Thank you. Questions for Director Carpenter? Yes, Senator Stevens.
We had a long love-hate relationships with nuclear power, and having seen them, those large cooling towers around the country, and now most of them are gone, I assume. And then we've been experiencing all of the horrible things going on in the Ukraine, where large nuclear plants have become targets. And the fear that if one of those plants had been hit, that it could have devastated a gigantic population. Is this really safe in a small community? Is it? Can it be a target for the enemy, whoever that might be? And would it cause damage, say, if we place one of these micro reactors in a small community? What would be the damage if that were attacked?
Ms. Carpenter?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, I believe that Gwen will get into some of the safety of these reactors during her presentation. Could we defer the question, or would you like Ms. Holtman to answer that now?
No, that's fine. Later's fine.
Okay, additional questions for Director Carpenter. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The definition of a microreactor has a reference to a federal law in it. And so it's that federal law reference and less than 50 megawatts. Can you tell us what are the strictures of that federal law? What does that limit us to?
I will leave that to whomever feels that Ms. Holdman would be best to answer that. I'll leave that up to you. Someone.
I'll defer to you, Gwen.
You are muted.
I apologize for that. I think that I would be more than happy to answer that particular question. If we could go ahead and if you would mind also deferring that question through the chair, Nachiki, I will be able to answer that through my presentation if that's all right with you. But it is related to the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, and the definition of a microreactor there is being under 50 megawatts of electric power and having characteristics associated with an advanced reactor, which is further defined in state statutes. And we also do have Ashley Finan, the director of the National Reactor Innovative Test Site at INL, and she can also provide a little bit more information on that if that is not adequate.
Thank you, Ms. Holdman. We can wait for the presentation. Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. I have a question for Ms. Carpenter, I think. So what we're doing is essentially exempting these smaller micro reactors, and not so they don't have to go through the regular legislative siting and permitting requirements and the requirement that there be studies done in advance. And I think in your testimony you said that there was another, that ASEP perhaps would be a better fit for an organization to do the sort of studies, and I'm just curious as to what those studies would look like and how they differ from the existing Title 18 requirements.
Senator Kalasafi, through the chair, there is still the requirement to do the study. Currently in statute, the requirement has, I think, six different state agencies having to do an ongoing study evaluating the various impacts of one of these reactors. So this would just exempt only for micro reactors, the requirement for that ongoing study, but it would still require a one-time study overseen by DEC and ASEP for the siting of these micro reactors.
Can I follow up? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So in 1845.025b, it does, part of the siting requirements talks about a nuclear reprocessing facility or where there will be nuclear waste disposal facilities and where those would be located. Would that still be part of the study that ASEP and DEC would do in lieu of the original facility siting permits?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki. Gwen, can you speak to that? Oh, you're muted.
Director Holdman, I think you can both stay unmuted.
Okay.
Sounds like we might be switching back and forth. So, Director Holdman.
All right. Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, are you referring to Section 1845.027 pertaining to nuclear waste?
Through the chair, actually, I'm still looking at 025. In subsection B, it talks about the land in the state in which, and there's a couple different things, where the nuclear fuel production facility will be, where the nuclear reprocessing facilities will be, and where the nuclear waste disposal facility will be located. And so I'm just wondering if the study that the DEC and ASEP would do would still require those types of things.
Yes, Senator Kawasaki, through the chair. So the section that that Christina is referring to is Section 1845.030. That's the studies related to nuclear development related to risks by these six different state agencies. And so we're not looking at changes to Section 025 other than removing legislative siting authority for a microreactor. We also aren't looking at any sort of changes at all to licensing requirements, including any subsequent studies that would be required for typical licensing requirements by state agencies. So it doesn't remove any of that. It's just removing the need for ongoing and continuous studies by these six agencies.
Senator Kawasaki?
Yeah. So in 030, the studies that are required before a permit is issued, just the first one is the Department of Health and Social Services would particularly look at hazards to the public health and safety. Would that be something that would be required still as a matter of course for microreactors?
So through the chair, none of these agencies, any permitting requirements by these agencies will still remain in place, and Christina Carpenter would be in a better position to describe what those might be. That's going to be a process that's actually developed by DEC as the lead state agency in this area. This does not relate at all to changes to actual permitting, state permitting of a reactor or the site that a reactor could be developed on. We're simply talking about this need for ongoing and continuous studies above and beyond existing licensing and permitting requirements for the reactor at the state level.
Director Carpenter, did you want to touch on that? Or do you feel like that answer is adequate?
I feel like that's adequate. Thank you.
Okay.
I guess, so the way I'm reading this, Mr. Chairman, is in Section 2 of the bill, it creates a new subsection B, and that new subsection B says that all the conducting of studies concerning laws and regulations with a view to atomic industrial development, that those are no longer required under this bill. And so I just wanted to clarify that I'm reading that right, that because it says the requirements set out in A of this section do not apply to the presence of microreactors.
Director Carpenter?
That's correct. So this would create a carve-out exempting microreactors from this ongoing study. And this work is being done by the national labs and ACIP. And it's, as Ms. Holdman said, the microreactor would still be subject to all of the requirements, the safety tests and permitting requirements by the NRC. And they would also be subject to any sort of DEC siting authority as well. But they would not be subject to that study requirement.
Thank you.
Okay, Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So I'm just curious, why the need for this? Are there a bunch of communities right now chomping on the bit to install these? And are there companies out there that have advanced technology that have solved the wastewater disposal who are currently manufacturing these at affordable prices?
Director, I'm sorry, Director Holdman.
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair. Those are really excellent questions. And these reactor technologies are something that currently has not been installed in the U.S., but we are expecting a number of different systems to be installed, both potentially in Alaska, a planned project at Allison Air Force Base, as well as other sites around the country, including at the National Reactor Innovation Center at Idaho National Lab. The director, Ashley Finan, is on the call today and is available to answer questions about that. One of the reasons for this bill at this time is really because we want to make these statutes were developed 40 years ago when these microreactors were not really something that was being considered at the national level. Now is the time where these are really being developed. In terms of your questions around safety and things like concerns about wastewater, I think my presentation can help answer a few of those questions. So we might want to wait or hold some of those questions until I am able to go through the presentation. But I do think that the need for this is because if there are communities in the state or facilities like Eielson Air Force Base that are interested in potentially hosting a microreactor, and as Christina Carpenter mentioned, Ms. Carpenter mentioned, this is largely, in our view, a local issue and not a statewide issue in terms of a small microreactor versus, say, a legacy gigawatt scale light water reactors we have seen that are installed in other parts of this country. And so that's really the purpose of this bill, is to address the fact that the technology has changed and evolved over the past 40 years. And so some aspects of this are no longer necessary given the current state of the technology and do inhibit the ability of communities or sites in the state to move forward with either feasibility or actually plan project development.
So I'd like to move on to the presentation. We're asking a high proportion of questions that seem to be included. I've flipped through it somewhat, but Senator Stevens has a question that's perhaps not related to presentation materials.
Well, okay, I'll wait.
Okay, please proceed with the presentation.
All right, thank you. So Ms. Bushnell, you're going to forward to the second slide, please, or the first slide. I just want to really acknowledge the National Lab technical experts that have been helping us in this process for quite some time. Today we have available, as I mentioned already, Ashley Finan. This has been a really fantastic partnership with the national labs, including Idaho National Lab and Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. To give a little bit of background on myself, I'm the director of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, but I've been actually working on this issue for a number of years. My background is in mechanical engineering and physics. I don't have a specific background in nuclear energy, but I have a background in thermal energy systems. I was, for example, a lead engineer of the Chena Hot Springs geothermal power plant. And so from that standpoint, some of the experience I have is certainly relevant to the application of nuclear reactor technologies. And this is something that our program has been quite interested in tracking for the last 12 years, actually at the request of the legislature. So if you could switch to the next slide, please. So the Alaska Center for Energy and Power is an applied energy research center based at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. And we look at a number of different sort of innovative energy solutions. We're very highly applied, looking at applications for Alaska communities and industry. Right before this presentation or this testimony today, I just gave an extended presentation to Hillcore, for example, related to some opportunities for energy solutions related to microreactors for some of our industries in the state. So that's the kind of work that we tend to do, very applied and very applicable to Alaska industries and communities. We have about 60 researchers that are based in both Fairbanks, Anchorage, and in Juneau, and have a really statewide focus in terms of the energy challenges that we work on. Next slide, please. We've developed two reports at the request of the legislature a decade apart in 2011 and 2021. The first report really focused on some of the history of nuclear energy utilization in Alaska, including proposed projects such as a Galena 10 megawatt Toshiba 4S project that was under consideration about almost 20 years ago now, as well as some of the testing, nuclear testing that was done in the state or proposed to be done in the state, or project development such as Project Chariot, the testing in Amchitka, and then Fort Greeley, which is the image in this particular slide, which is the only reactor that was ever actually deployed in the state of Alaska in 1962, partly decommissioned in 1972, and actually final decommissioning will be starting this year. Next slide, please. So our more recent report, completed last year, also at the request of the legislature, really continues to track technology and policy and regulatory trends. We proposed and have subsequently created a state working group on small nuclear energy as a forum to bring together stakeholders at both the state level, so within the state, and then also making sure that we're sharing information with stakeholders at the national level, including industries, so they understand Alaska use cases and Alaska sort of context in terms of our environmental conditions and our use cases for both industry and communities in the state. We are working toward developing a roadmap for Alaska nuclear energy applications, working closely with our state agency partners, including DEC, AEA, and other relevant state agencies. Really taking a close look at specific use cases and doing a more robust economic analysis, especially for microreactors, how they can be applied in the state, and valuing heat in addition to electric power output from these. And then our last recommendation was really related to this bill, to SB 177, which is reviewing and revising Alaska state statutes related to nuclear energy. We went pretty carefully through all of the state statutes and made these three recommendations for changes that acknowledge the evolving nature of the technology. Next slide, please. So, Senator Stevens, I actually wanted to provide a few basic facts about nuclear energy. And you mentioned the cooling towers that are typically seen in association with legacy nuclear reactors in the rest of the country. The U.S. actually produces more nuclear energy today than any other country in the world in terms of megawatt hours produced, and it actually supplies 20% of the U.S. Baseload electric power needs, which is more than all renewables, including hydroelectric, put together. So it's actually a very major part of our overall power generation in the country. And, you know, another fact is that in the 60-year history of the nuclear power industry, including 30 deployments in 36 different countries, there's really only been 3 significant accidents involving nuclear power. And so by many metrics, actually, the nuclear energy industry has the best safety record and the least deaths per megawatt hour produced of basically any power generation system of our traditional power generation fleet. So I just wanted to state that as some background context. This is related to our legacy nuclear power plant industry, which is different from microreactors and advanced reactors that I'm going to be talking about next. So next slide, please. So microreactors are specifically this emerging class of small advanced reactors with the following general attributes: generally have an output of less than 10 megawatts of electric power. So now, in the terms of our particular definition that we're using for making recommendations to statutes, we did pick this 50 megawatt threshold. That is a little bit of an arbitrary threshold, but it does align with this definition that is in the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. And so we felt it was important not to create our own definition, but to align ourselves with federal definitions. And then that references these advanced reactor designs that has additional attributes that I'll talk a little bit more about. This was done with recommendation, with consultation with our national lab partners. So a few other things that are different. Typically, nuclear reactors are baseload electric power for our national power generation fleet. But these microreactors are really designed to be much more flexible and capable of load following, as well as provide non-electric applications, including process heat for industry, for example. They're designed to be factory fabricated and transportable, nearly fully assembled, which means that they're going to be designed to much closer tolerances in terms of factory specifications and lower costs in terms of having more of a kind of a cookie cutter approach to developing and constructing these systems. And also because they're designed to be transported to a site nearly fully assembled, they're going to require a smaller operational footprint. So they employ these passive safe operating and fuel designs, which are something that I think is really important for Alaskans to understand. And that's something I'll spend a little bit more time talking about. And then this idea of like semi-autonomous control system and minimal on-site staffing requirements, and then long intervals without refueling. So in some ways, these could almost be considered like a thermal battery, basically a heat source that you can then use for power generation or other sorts of heat applications. And then they're designed, some of them, the reactor is designed to be removed in whole and then replaced in the field. Some of them also have protocols for in-field refueling, but they're generally very long periods of time, either between refueling or replacement of that reactor core. And I'll pause between slides just in case there are additional questions. But next slide, please. So this slide is from our report, and it does show, I just want to make sure we're on the same. Could you go to the next? Oh, I apologize. I'm not keeping up with you guys. I think, could you go to the next slide, please? The one with the image. Yes, that one. Thank you. So this kind of gives an idea of some of the companies that are actively pursuing licensing through the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, so looking at a U.S. market for their technology. And you can kind of see here where there's this kind of clear bifurcation at about that 10 megawatt electric scale. So below that, you see a number of manufacturers that kind of fit in that sort of micro reactor definition that fall under that. And then those that are larger than that, many of those fall under what might be called a modular reactor design, where those are really designed ultimately to replace some of the legacy reactors in the U.S. by having this more modular approach to having several different reactors deployed at the same site, but then being able to work on them individually, having less than nuclear material, and those falling under this advanced design advanced nuclear design that has these inherent and intrinsic safety features. So next slide, please. This gives a couple examples of micronuclear reactors that are under deployment that have expressed interest in the Alaska market. They're not the only ones, but I'll just give a couple of examples.
Director Holdman?
Yes.
You said under deployment. Did you mean under development?
Under development. My mistake. I apologize, Chair Machicki. So UltraSafe Nuclear Corporation, USNC, is a Seattle-based company. They're looking at deployments both potentially in Alaska. They're working on a feasibility study with Copper Valley Electric Association. They're also looking at doing a demonstration project at Chalk River, which is a national laboratory nuclear lab in Canada, actually. So they've been considering this idea of a feasibility study, or they're working on a feasibility study with Copper Valley, looking at potentially deploying a system in Valdez. And then the Westinghouse eVinci reactor design is a slightly smaller and probably more modular design. That's really proposed to be deployed in a series of like four oversized Connex containers, only one of which would house the actual micro reactor. You can kind of see the size of it compared to a typical sized human here in this image. The USNC reactor is designed to be deployed below ground, whereas the eVinci reactor is designed to be deployed above grade. So those are just two examples. So the next slide, so really talking about what this passive safety means, and the way I sort of break it down, or I think about it, is that there's really two components to that passive or inherent safety, and one is related to the fuel configuration itself. So the idea is that there are these new fuel configurations that have been developed over, you know, the last decade or so, and so one example would be TRISO particles, which are tristructural isotopic particles, which are kind of designed with this with the uranium, with the fuel at the core, with like multiple layers of basically various kinds of advanced carbon materials that are really heat resistant and that can withstand the temperatures and any stresses, any physical stresses that are well beyond the threshold of what would be expected to be experienced under any kinds of operating or unexpected sort of events within a reactor. So basically, the fuel itself cannot come in contact with the environment under any conditions. And then secondly, this passive cooling feature, and this is kind of where many of the reactors, when you think about something like Fukushima, where you hear of a meltdown of a reactor core, in that case, those reactors those legacy reactors require active cooling mechanisms to remove heat from the core. And so in the case of a microreactor, number one, there's much less nuclear material in any one place. And number two, that heat from the reactor core is designed to be removed through passive thermodynamic and physical processes that occur without the need for any kind of active human intervention or the need for pumps or any kinds of external electric power or anything like that. And so that's like a pretty big difference between these micro reactors or really advanced reactors, because micro reactor in and of itself just talks about maybe the size of the reactor, but advanced reactors really have these sort of multiple layers of safety that I believe make them a totally different category of nuclear power than our legacy plants and what has been deployed previously. Next slide, please. So I'll just like include a couple examples here that maybe resonate with some Alaskan audiences. So one example of that passive removal of heat is through heat pipes. And so this is what we see with the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. You can see those kind of iconic fins that we often see along the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. And so that's really about heat removal to keep the ground frozen and stable. That's using ammonia. That's a very different kind of temperature range that we're working at, but the concept is basically the same, that passive removal of heat using a working fluid, and that is an example of something that the eVinci reactor uses. Next slide, please. I already mentioned, Okay, you're ahead of me a little bit now. Okay, sorry. I wish I could forward my own slides, so I don't know. So I'm basically... I'm just going to go ahead and skip ahead to where you are, okay? So you guys have the slides, you have a copy of them, and you can see the point that I'm making about them being modular and also having that load following capability that's similar to diesel generators in the state of Alaska. It looks to me like you're on slide 16, which is related to the state
statute. We are on slide 14, just after the drawing that you just had of what a unit looks like on slide 12 or 13. I'm sorry, slide 13. So this is slide 14.
Okay, my apologies. I can see the slides up in front of you, and it looks like it's the one that says state statutes related to nuclear. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you. So this slide, we've already sort of reviewed these various state statutes, but we've gone through all of the statutes that relate to nuclear energy. These are not, this is not an exhaustive list, but this is this expresses a lot of the ones that we sort of identified as at least being something worth taking a closer look at and explains what they do. Slide 17 pertains to the three that, as Ms. Carpenter described, that this particular bill relates to or recommends changes to. So I'm not going to spend time on that right now because I feel like we have already reviewed that. The next slide, please. This is another area that we've really been looking pretty closely at the university. This is with UAA, the Center for Economic Development. I'm doing a use case analysis of whether microreactors have a role in the future of Alaska's energy mix and looking at four prospective use cases. So next slide, please. That includes a rural hub community, a rail belt application, military base, and a mining operation, and kind of taking a look at those in a little bit more detail. Next slide, please. So related to rural applications, you know, this is a question that we've got in other committee hearings. And so I just want to make the point that there are a limited number of communities in rural Alaska that have enough load and potentially a high enough heating demand that would even hypothetically be able to host a microreactor of the size that we're talking about right now. And so these are some examples of those here. Next slide, please.
We have a question on this slide. Senator Von Imhoff.
So thank you. So your previous slide, you talked about a mining operation or a military base. So in your map there, then on number 18, if you have Dillingham, that's three, I'm assuming it's MW megawatts.
Correct.
And Bethel, 7 megawatts. What would a mining operation like Donlin Creek or Fort Knox or Red Dog?
Thank you, Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair. Mining operations typically have fairly high loads compared to these communities, actually. So their demand would be more in the tens of megawatts, typically, although some smaller mines, like, for example, Graphite One, which is a potential mining prospect outside of Nome, Alaska, it might be less than that, like 6 or 7 megawatts, but typically in the tens of megawatts.
Okay, can I one more question? Is that okay?
Certainly.
Okay, so when you look at Fairbanks or Anchorage, where our military hubs are as well, and I know that you had highlighted a military base, for example, Eielson, is in the Fairbanks, the 223 megawatts, is that include Eielson or is that separate from, is that just Fairbanks residential and commercial?
Thank you, Senator Van Amhal, through the chair. So that is the load for Golden Valley Electric Association. Eielson Air Force Base primarily is connected to the Golden Valley grid, but primarily self-generates from a coal plant, so it would not be included in that number right there. And so this, just to be clear, this is just communities. It's not showing all potential applications in the state.
Certainly.
Okay, continue, please.
Next slide. Yes, okay, that slide. So this National Reactor Innovation Center, Dr. Finan is on the call with us today. She can answer some questions about this, but this is actually where many of these advanced reactors are expected to be tested over the next decade. And so we're lucky to have her working with us and working with the state of Alaska on this question. Next slide, please. So this Eielson Air Force Base microreactor project is not the cause of this bill being developed, but it is actually a good example of why I do believe that these changes to state statutes are needed. So this is a planned project at Eielson Air Force Base. And actually, let's go to the next slide. It shows a few more details about the reactor that's proposed to be developed there. 1 to 5 megawatts of electric power output. It would not be grid connected, so just on-site heat and power for Eielson Air Force Base. That does not provide all of the demand there, so it would be run in parallel with the existing coal-fired power plant. I do believe that the Air Force, ideally, if this is a successful demonstration, would love to replace the coal plant there with additional modules of a microreactor, but that's not the plan right now. So it is a commercial project, so it will be licensed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is the lead agency nationally for microreactors and any nuclear reactors, but it's also going to be subject to state regulations. And that's kind of partially where this this bill would impact this potential project here. So the idea is that it would be privately owned and operated through a power purchase agreement with the Air Force. The RFP for this project was expected to be released this month, could be pushed to next month, but as I understand it, we're going to be seeing that really soon, with the vendor selected in later this year. And then you can see that construction and commercial operation the project would be commissioned in 2027.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Stevens.
If we could come back to my rampant paranoia about having a nuclear reactor in my backyard. It is concerning to me that Eielson, you know, we know that if there was ever a target by China or Russia, it would be Eielson, probably before the pipeline. It would be a target. Do you have any concerns about a nuclear reactor at Eielson that could be exploded and damage the entire area? And a connecting question would be, what are the people of Fairbanks? Can they have a choice about whether they want a nuclear reactor so near them?
Yeah, Senator Stevens, through the chair, those are excellent questions. I'm going to call on Dr. Finan to answer the first one, but I'll actually answer the second one first. And so what this bill does not do is it doesn't remove local siting authority over this. So in this case, Eielson Air Force Base is located in the Fairbanks North Star Borough. And so the Fairbanks North Star Borough will have some decision-making over the development of this project that they will have authority over, not the state legislature, should this bill be passed.
And that would be the same thing for villages, small communities. They have the choice whether they want this or not.
Absolutely. And in fact, Senator Stevens, through the chair, the NRC actually has a fairly robust process for consent-based siting for any kind of nuclear facility. And so that's sort of the expectation for how this would go. And so, again, this doesn't remove any sort of local control in a borough or a municipal government in the state of Alaska. If a project that is proposed would be sited outside of a municipality or a borough, the siting authority would revert back to the legislature.
Thank you, Gwen.
Okay, so am I going to Dr. Finan?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
It was on that question. Did you want me to go to Dr. Finan to answer Senator Stevens' question?
Dr. Finan, would you be willing to put yourself on
that's,
record?
That's my job.
Thank you.
Was that a yes? Okay, Dr. Finan, can you please or Director Finan, could you please answer Senator Stevens' question about the risk of such a reactor being a target?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is Ashley Finan from the National Reactor Innovation Center. And so I appreciate the question. We can go back to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which I know Ms. Holdman has referred to a few times. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission in the U.S. does oversee and have requirements for security and hardness of reactors. So microreactors, just like all of our reactors in the United States, would be designed to withstand external events, including natural events like tornadoes, earthquakes, high winds, and those sorts of events, as well as human-caused events like attacks, airplane impact, and any sort of external impact. And so they are designed to protect against those threats. Also, as we look at advanced reactors, Ms. Holdman described some of the key features of advanced reactors. They include these inherent safety principles and inherent safety features that make them more resilient in the event of an external, a negative external event, either weather or human caused, such that they don't require off-site power in order to cool down and shut down safely. They have really robust fuel forms, in particular some advanced fuel that's been developed over the last decade or so, that is more resilient against things like impact. So I will stop there, but I'll also offer that we can provide more of a written response in follow-up if that's useful.
Yeah, Senator Stevens?
And just to follow up, thank you very much, Dr. Fine. I appreciate that. And of course, we're all watching what's going on in the Ukraine and the target issue there. So you're telling me that a Stinger missile hitting a nuclear reactor at Eielson would not have any impact on human beings about a release of any nuclear energy or anything like that. Can you say that?
So I am not familiar with Stinger missiles. I'm sorry, my technical knowledge of weapons is non-existent, basically. I can follow up on that, but we don't have access to the details of the threats that nuclear plants are protected against. We have some general information. We have information that they're protected against missiles, but a specific Stinger missile, it wouldn't be able to find that out. So those standards exist. They're just classified for reasons you can imagine. But I can look into it and see what I could find out for you.
Thank you, Dr. Fine. And I don't mean to hang this up on a Stinger missile. Any kind of missile that seems to be dangerous.
Yeah, thank you. Ms. Finan, can you please provide, through Senator Rivak's office, provide whatever data you have on kind of the general risk versus of a microreactor versus conventional nuclear and some perhaps attack data and what that might look like. I don't know how to define it further, but I think you heard Senator Stevens' questions. They're good questions. I think that would be helpful.
Yes, I will. Thank you.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess on that point, I have a number of family members who lived many, many years near one of America's nuclear sites. And security is a human endeavor. And I can tell you that the history of human endeavor and security arena at that nuclear site is not the sort of thing that would inspire confidence. So perhaps that information you requested would do more to inspire that confidence, if possible. I did have a question from just a moment earlier. Director Holdman said that if one of these sites were outside a municipality, siting authority would revert back to the legislature. That's not in the statute. I wonder if you could point me to where that authority lies.
Ms. Holdman?
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, Christina, did you want to go ahead and take that?
Yeah, yes. For the record, this is Christina Carpenter with the Department of Environmental Conservation.
I can follow up with the committee on the exact statutory language that would indicate that that would refer back to the legislature.
Okay, thank you. All right, Ms. Holdman, if you want to continue, I think we're on slide 22.
Yeah. Thank you. So slide 22, essentially, these are good questions that we're asking here today, and we are hoping to work, continue to work to identify both answers to these really good questions that you have and that other Alaskans have, and developing kind of a state roadmap. We've been working really closely with Enric, with Ashley and her team on starting to pencil out what this might look like. This is actually a slide from our 2011 report, so it's a decade old or more, but it does kind of show these sorts of, this rubric or these stage gates that we envision. You know, does the technology exist? If it is it safe? Is it environmentally responsible to deploy in Alaska? And is it cost effective? Like, these are essentially the questions that we feel Alaskans need answers to in order to feel like this is an opportunity or an option for them for the future. And I want to make it clear that the purpose of this bill isn't to promote nuclear energy. It's to create space for communities and for our industries to consider this as a future option for part of their energy mix. So I'll just kind of leave you with a concluding slide here. Just to be clear again, we don't promote one technology over another, but this is one that I think is something that we should be keeping an eye on and is of interest to Alaska. In fact, I think that one of the members of this committee, Senator Bishop, actually put forward a bill in 2020 related to making many of these same sorts of amendments. But this is why I'm personally interested in small reactors. I think that the idea of providing reliable baseload energy in the terms of heat and power to Alaskan communities and industry is something that's very interesting. The fact that they are designed to load follow, so that means that they have the potential to firm up renewables and to provide, to meet variable demand. For potential industry needs is pretty interesting. The fact that it's carbon-free, many of our industries are moving toward lower carbon solutions. And so this is one way that we can look at reducing our carbon footprint or allowing them to reduce their carbon footprint. I have some question marks after these next few. I do believe that these are safer, but the question is compared to what? You know, we've been talking a lot today in this committee about safety compared to legacy nuclear reactor technology or light water reactor technology. I'm also interested in understanding what the potential safety implications are compared to status quo technologies that we are now using in the state, for example, diesel generation. There's also environmental costs or contamination associated with status quo technologies. And so understanding and comparing those to a micro reactor is something that I'm very interested in doing. Competitive pricing, that's sort of it has to be competitively priced. And so, again, the question about that is, what's the value of heat? What's the value of long-term certainty of energy costs as well? If you know what your energy costs are going to be over 10 years, that can have value in and of itself. So, again, that question about reduced risk of environmental contamination compared to status quo energy technologies and compared to other legacy reactor technologies. And then I do think that it has a potential to complement the existing Alaska resource mix. So that's sort of why I'm interested in micro reactors. And I think that this bill creates the space to allow our communities and our industries to consider this as part of their future energy mix. And that's why I would, that's why I'm supporting the passage of this particular bill.
Senator Keel has a question.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. I apologize if my questions seem a little touchy. I'm not quite as, I wouldn't use Senator Stevens' word paranoid, but I do have a lot of questions. There was a statement, I think, on an earlier slide that nobody's died as a result of radiation exposure from a commercial nuclear reactor. The Japanese Ministry of Health, Labor, and Welfare disagrees with that statement. They have compensated families of Fukushima Daiichi cleanup workers for deaths from the radiation. And so I want to kind of drill in just a little bit more. And I'll go back to my earlier question about the definition that's referenced in the bill of an advanced nuclear reactor. The bill says any advanced nuclear reactor under a certain capacity is micro. Did that change in the Infrastructure and Jobs Act, that definition? What, or can we talk a little bit about what that definition means? There was sort of a vision statement in the slides, but I'm interested in the legal language.
Ms. Holdman?
Thank you, Senator. Through the chair, we actually put a lot of effort into looking at a number of different definitions for microreactor. And again, you know, there isn't like some sort of a size threshold that is kind of that bar above which something is a microreactor or not a microreactor. One of the concerns that we had is that some of the developers are proposing designs that are at that 10 megawatt threshold or even slightly above it. And so what we didn't want to do is have to go back and revise statutes again, because there was a reactor design that if we said 10 megawatts is the threshold for a microreactor and they're proposing a 12 megawatt design, we didn't want to go back and adjust that. We also didn't want to create our own unique definition in the state. So this was the route that the governor's office actually chose to pursue in terms of aligning with the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act and that 50 megawatt of electric power in an advanced definition, which is a separate definition in and of itself. Chairman Chickie, I would invite you to ask for any additional clarification from Dr. Finan if she is able to provide that.
Okay. Dr. Finan, could you add some, round up that question?
This is Ashley Finan, for the record. I think that Gwen described very well the reason for the level that's being set, and I'm not aware of the background of that as well as Ms. Holdman is. But I think from my perspective, the focus of my work is on advanced reactors that have advanced safety features and advanced features that are suitable for different markets. And it does seem as though there are many applications around the country, and particularly in Alaska, that makes sense for the 50 megawatt and lower range of microreactors. But there isn't a hard line for what is and isn't a microreactor from a technical perspective. I think about these as mostly advanced reactors where we do achieve those inherent safety features and other aspects, but like, as Ms. Holdman described early on, the limitation of potential impacts to the site boundary, that's an important characteristic of advanced reactors, and it applies to these microreactors, but it also applies to larger advanced reactors than the ones being considered in this definition in this bill. And I hope that's helpful. I'm happy to answer more questions if that didn't answer the question.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. I guess the reason I ask, unless there was there's a new definition in the federal law, what you're describing is significantly more restrictive than what you're citing to in the bill. And the definition that I'm finding online in that federal law is literally anything that makes any improvement at all over the nuclear reactor tech that existed 2 years ago. Right? You get one more BTU out of a unit of fuel, and you're an advanced reactor. You could change nothing about the reactor and bolt a better modulator on to integrate with other loads in the grid, and you're an advanced reactor. So if that's the definition we're looking for in the bill, maybe we should talk about what we actually want to say. Did I have another question? I thought I did, Mr. Chairman. The safety of the fuels. If I could pivot just briefly to that, I lack the scientific knowledge to evaluate the safety of that fuel pellet that was in one of the slides. And I wonder if we could get some discussion of if those were somehow released, if those were somehow spread around, whether that's through the sort of foreign military attack or terrorism scenario discussed earlier. What is the context to the release of those in the environment?
Dr. Finan?
Sure, this is Ashley Finan with Idaho National Lab. With that, so a couple things regarding that fuel. What you're referring to is commonly called TRISO fuel, which is not important, but I'll use the name. And the major innovation there is that it's distinctly different from the fuel we have today in that it traps the radioactive materials inside the fuel. A lot of the fuel that operates in today's reactors, when we have products of the fission reaction, you end up with radioactive gases that leave the fuel pellet and are contained within another material, a cladding, that keeps it contained. But if that cladding melts, then that radioactive gas is released into the coolant, and if several barriers fail, that can be released into the environment. This advanced fuel does not cause these gaseous products to leave to be contained by a cladding that can easily fail. Instead, it's in the silicon carbide and graphite matrix that does not fail at the temperatures that a reactor will hit even in a worst case accident. So what that means is that you don't release radioactive gases into the coolant, and then you don't have the potential to release those into the environment if multiple barriers fail, which is our current situation. So since it stays in this pebble and it stays in the fuel, that means that losing the core configuration or having things break still retains those fission products and the radioactive materials in the vicinity of the reactor, right, or in the reactor. That's how you are able to reduce that emergency planning zone from the potential space that a gas can travel to the potential space that essentially a solid can travel, which is much, much smaller. That's why we moved from that 10 or 50 mile emergency planning zone down to the site boundary. And just as an illustrative example, the Department of Defense is pursuing some demonstrations of microreactors for use in forward operating locations to provide the clean, secure energy that they want without the diesel fuel supply lines, with which we know are real vulnerabilities in our national defense, in our activities overseas, and a place where we lose a lot of our servicemen and servicewomen. And they have required that as they look at a microreactor for those forward operating locations, they're requiring that those designs use TRISO fuel, because we've spent the last 10 to 15 years really proving how well that works. We've seen it, we've made it fail, or tried to make it fail in test reactors. We've seen the Chinese and the Germans and others try to make it fail. And it's so robust that it is the fuel of choice for these forward operating based military microreactor designs.
Senator Keel, follow up?
No, I'll hold off on this one. Thanks.
Okay. Senator Kawasaki?
Yeah, thank you. I think this is for Dr. Finan. Finan, what happens to the spent nuclear fuel or the waste produced during reprocessing?
Sure. So this is Ashley Finan for the record. And the so there is no reprocessing necessary for these advanced reactors, though some of them envision it as a possibility in their future fuel cycles. But it would, to my knowledge, any proposals that are looking at deployment in the near term in the United States, they're not moving towards reprocessing in the near term. That said, the waste products of the reactors or of the reprocessing would be handled the way that our nuclear byproducts are handled today. So for spent nuclear fuel right now, that is a robust storage system until there's a final disposal site or until there's a reprocessing route. And for other types of waste other than spent nuclear fuel, they're classified by low level or high level, and they're managed appropriately to their level of radioactivity or toxicity. So there are a variety of different approaches to that that are well established. And yeah, I'll stop there. Thank you.
Okay, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's a good discussion, and I, you know, I don't want to give the wrong impression. These could be the best thing since cheese. I just don't understand well enough yet. I wonder on the safety elements, could you point me? Could one of the presenters point me to maybe do some research? Where are the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's regulations for these commercial small nuclear or micronuclear reactors? Where would I start to read up?
Dr. Finan?
Sure, happy to take that question. Thank you. If you go to nrc.gov, you'll find the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's website, and there they have a library that has their various references, including all of their regulations, but we could also follow up to point you in the direction of the different regulations. And in particular, there are some details on security as well as safety that we could point you towards if that'd be helpful. NRC.gov has all of the information.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, if there are no other questions, and it sounds like our presentation is complete, I think you're hearing some of the questions just generally, and they're great questions, but there's definitely a comparison between, you know, the Kashiwazaki type plant that's near a gigawatt facility operated by Tokyo Electric in facility that is designed to serve millions versus much, much, much smaller facility. So if we can get a better understanding of the quantity and potential between conventional nuclear and advanced microreactor technology with sources, I think that'd be helpful for the committee. I think you know the questions, or you heard the questions from today, and we are going to be opening public testimony, but we are not moving this bill today, so this is kind of a fact-finding mission for the committee. Is there any further questions before we go to public testimony? Seeing none, thank you for your presentation today, Ms. Holdman, and others that were here. We're going to move on to public testimony. So public testimony on Senate Bill 177 is now open. Do we have anyone in the room wishing to testify on SB 177? Seeing none, do we have anyone online? Is that Mr. Ravito? Is he here for public testimony from the Alaska Power Association? Michael, are you there? And if so, please provide your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is Michael Ravito, Deputy Director of Alaska Power Association, or APA. APA is a statewide trade association for electric utilities in Alaska, and our members provide power throughout the state. APA supports Senate Bill 177, and we urge its passage so electric utilities considering microreactors can move forward with their potential projects, confidently knowing that a portion of the permitting process has been streamlined. Our electric utility members are constantly innovating and integrating new technologies that support their mission of providing safe, reliable, and affordable power. Microreactors are a viable source of power that has the potential to lower the cost of energy for Alaskans, decrease dependency on diesel, better position our state for economic development opportunities, and raise Alaska's profile as a hub of energy innovation and energy independence. It's important to point out that electric utilities seeking to permit microreactors will still have to satisfy state and federal permitting requirements, along with any local requirements, before the project can be constructed. SB 177 helps to streamline the process by exempting microreactors under 50 megawatts from legislative siting authority and from numerous ongoing study requirements. Alaska's electric utilities provide power amid harsh conditions, vast distances, and a lack of interconnection to the lower 48 regional grids. By passing SB 177, the legislature will help our state's electric utilities more easily access a viable option for providing safe, reliable, and affordable power in the last frontier. And thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Rivito. Not seeing any questions, we'll move on to Courtney Owen. Courtney, are you there? And can you provide your testimony, please?
Hi. For the record, this is Courtney Owen, Civic Engagement Coordinator from the Alaska Community Action on Toxics. These comments were prepared by Pamela Miller, our Senior Scientist and Executive Director. Thank you, Chair and members of the Senate Resources Committee, for considering our perspective on SB 177. The Alaska Community Action on Toxics is a statewide nonprofit environmental health and justice research and advocacy organization based in Anchorage. We oppose SB 177 because it allows that so-called micronuclear reactors are not subject to certain nuclear reactor siting and permitting regulations in Alaska and may be constructed on land that has not been designated by the legislature. There are serious health and safety concerns with micronuclear reactors, and they are a false solution for our energy needs and the climate crisis. Nuclear power is destructive throughout its life cycle, from the mining of uranium, which is done predominantly on indigenous lands, through the enrichment process, to the untenable problems of disposal of radioactive waste. On January 6, 2022, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission determined that OCLO failed to provide sufficient information on topics such as potential accidents and certain safety systems. Microreactor vendors are pushing to reduce or even eliminate entirely personnel such as operators and security officers. In a report about the safety of advanced nuclear reactors, the Union of Concerned Scientists determined that leaving the microreactors without human guards is not safe. Even a very small reactor contains enough radioactive material to cause a big problem if it is sabotaged, and none of these reactors have demonstrated that they are so safe that they can function without operators. A single OCLO micro reactor core would contain about 10 nuclear weapons worth of nuclear and radioactive material. According to the UCS report, nuclear technology has fundamental safety and security disadvantages compared with other low carbon or renewable sources. Nuclear reactors and their associated facilities for fuel production and waste handling are vulnerable to catastrophic accidents and sabotage, and they can be misused to produce material for nuclear weapons. It is disturbing that the primary proponents of this are representatives from the nuclear power industry who have a vested interest. Opening the door to nuclear power again in Alaska is unwise and dangerous. We are still addressing the radioactive legacy of massive radioactive contamination from the experimental SM-1A nuclear reactor at Fort Greely that was a colossal failure. As the Union of Concerned Scientists noted in their recent report evaluating modern nuclear technologies, including micronuclear reactors, quote unquote, advanced isn't always better. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Owen. Appreciate your testimony very much. Yes, Senator Stevens.
I wonder if she could provide us, Ms. Owen, could you provide us information on Fort Greely? I'm not familiar with that. It'd be interesting to know what happened there.
I can get that information to you via Pamela Miller. I'm sure she has a report that she could mail or email to you, or if that would be okay.
Yeah, yes, perfect. Thank you.
Can I just double check?
Certainly.
So thank you.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. You said something. Can you look back at your notes? Did you say one microreactor is equivalent to 10 nuclear bombs? Is that what you said? Did I catch that
it
right?
It says a single OCLO microreactor core would contain about 10 nuclear weapons worth of nuclear and radioactive material.
Senator Von Imhoff.
So which, I mean, I'm not going to split hairs here, but that's actually really funny. I've split some atoms, that's right. I just would like to know what nuclear weapons are you talking about? Because you're creating a comparison that I'm just curious if my own mind is jumping to the right conclusion or not. So if you could maybe let us know, well, what does that mean? Because we're hearing this other presentation that said it's very contained. It's only 50 megawatts or up to 50 megawatts, I think is what the bill stated. So, for example, what is the bombs that in World War II, was that 50 megawatts or was that 5 megawatts?
Like I said, can I refer you to our senior scientist for that? I'm just here.
Ms. Owen, that would be fine. Thank you for that. Other questions? I'm sorry to cut it off, but we're getting into, from my own experience in energy projects, I've had the comparison of the conversion of BTUs to megatons, kilotons on a regular basis. We'd like it based on factual reality, and we can also ask that same question of Ms. Finan, who's the director of the National Reactor Innovation Center, just to get a better perspective on that comparison. So thank you. We're now going to Gary Newman from Fairbanks. Mr. Newman.
Yes, greetings, Chairman Chickie and members of the committee. My name is Gary Newman, a 50-year resident of Fairbanks, Alaska. I've long worked with and closely followed energy technology and policy in conjunction with my professional careers. To be transparent, I serve on the Golden Valley Electric Board of Directors, but my testimony is solely mine. I've participated in ASEP's nuclear working group and listened to testimony before legislative committees. By no means expert in the highly technical details of the proposed technologies, I am able to critically evaluate what's being proposed. Most of the testimony is coming from proponents of the potential technology, with others just opposed to nuclear at all. I'd like to take a practical approach. One, I would agree that the legislature is not the appropriate body for citing authority. In conjunction with state agencies, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska is the more logical authority. Two, removing the requirements of ongoing studies otherwise required in 1845.030 is problematic. DEC is not the only agency that should have purview over this, as the list of departments in that section demonstrate. Instead of eliminating all ongoing studies, just remove ongoing from that description. Why would you not want state departments to look at this new technology for regulations? As to local control, most small municipalities do not have the capacity or legislative authority to analyze and regulate this. For example, in Fairbanks, it takes a simple conditional use permit approval by the Planning Commission for a nuclear power plant. Alaskans often say we need more local control, whether at the state or local levels. SB 177 does the opposite and is premature, as all would agree this technology is in its infancy. The pilot project at Eielson might be functional in 2027. Copper Valley is looking at a feasibility with a similar timeline. Let's see how these develop before absolving the state of most regulatory engagement. To conclude, the state of Alaska needs to have a stake in the evaluation and operation of the still new power generation methodology. Please just eliminate ongoing in 1845.030B and consider changing the siting authority from the legislature to the RCA, who already have siting authority for power plants as a consequence of regulations implemented from SB 123. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Newman. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, sir. Really appreciate that. Can you submit that in writing? You had some excellent points. It would be nice to have that in writing, please.
I would be happy to.
Other questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Newman, for your testimony.
Appreciate your work on the committee.
I don't see anyone else online. Is that correct? Yes. Okay. Thank you all for your testimony today. With that, we are going to close public testimony on Senate Bill 177. This time, we will set the bill aside for members to review research and to speak to relevant departments and stakeholders. I know we have a lot of information coming in, and I look forward to reviewing that myself. We will now take up HB 79.
Briefities.
Thank you. We'll now take up HB 79, Saltwater Sport Fishing Operators Guides, under bills previously heard. There was discussion in committee regarding the need or lack of a need to include freshwater language in this bill. We've worked with the committee and the department to reflect that in a possible CS. That being said, I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Senate Resource Committee adopt the Senate CS for House Bill number 79 Resources, version 32-GH1608/G as our working document.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. Mr. Harbison, can you please put yourself on the record and discuss the changes in the CS?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Intamayo Harbison, Senate Resources Committee Aide and staff to Senator Reback. The CS before you reverts a number of changes made by the representative from District 29 in House Finance that added requirements for freshwater fishing licensure and reporting. These changes are considered redundant as the department already has the authority to monitor freshwater fishing. And so the CS before you would revert those changes made by the representative from District 29. This change would also bring the bill back in line with the original bill title, which pertains specifically to saltwater sport fishing. With that, I will go through the explanation of changes between version I and the proposed version G.
Okay, please proceed.
In section 1, makes the license types in the bill specific to saltwater guides and operators. Section 2 reverts back to version A, which makes licensing requirements specific to saltwater guides and operators. Section 3 are conforming amendments to Title 25, which reference the above licenses. Section 4 changes the due date of legislative report to December 31st, 2023. And Section 5 changes the effective date to January 1st, 2023.
Thank you, Mr. Harbison. I'll also mention that we have the Commissioner of Fish and Game online, Commissioner Vincent Lang and Tom Tobe, Operations Manager, Division of Sport Fish, if there are any questions from members. Seeing none and no other questions, I'll remove my objection. Are there any further objections to adopting the Senate CS for House Bill number 79, Resources Version G, as our working document? Seeing none, HB 79 version G is adopted as a working document and is now before the committee. Are there any questions or is there further discussion on HB 79?
Mr. Chairman, you say the commissioner is online.
Yes.
Could we just get his reaction to all we've done?
I'm sorry, we have lost the commissioner. We do have Mr. Tobe online. I think I'm saying that correctly, but... would you like to hear from the Division Ops Manager for Sportfish?
Yes.
And I don't know if the commissioner can try to come back, but Mr. Tobe, did you hear, do you have a question specifically, Senator Stevens?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Senator Stevens, through the chair, the CS is essentially the same language that was submitted as the governor's bill. So the department would be accepting of these changes.
Thank you, Mr. Tobe.
Yeah, am I saying it correctly, Mr. Tobe?
It's Mr. Taube. Taube. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much. So I have a follow-up. In the presentation by Senator Reback's staff, you said that there's already a system, freshwater system, which is why these changes are redundant. Can you please explain that?
Mr. Chair, I believe Chair Reback was referring to that we have the ability to implement freshwater logbooks through our authorities already. We do not have freshwater logbooks at this time, but we do have freshwater guide registration, so we do know how many guides are operating based on our budgetary situation and our need for any in-season management for freshwater, we don't feel that the freshwater log books at this time are really necessary.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Seeing none, do we have a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the CS for CS for House Bill 79 Resources Version 32-GH1608 /G be moved from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Is there are there any objections? Seeing none, the Senate Bill 79 will move from committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations. We can sign the paperwork once we adjourn. Thank you, committee members, for being here and for your attention today. Thanks to presenters as well as the committee. Our next regularly scheduled meeting will be this coming Wednesday, March 23rd, 2022, where we will review Senate Bill 230, Trapping Cabins, Fee for Construction. This meeting is now, we're all good on the moving out of the bill, right? We covered everything. Okay, this meeting is adjourned at 4:57 p.m.